That's Terrence Blanchard with On the Verge. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It's Monday, April the 29th. And a Mississippi man who describes himself as a patriot with no grudges against anyone appeared in court today on charges of making and possessing ricin, part of the investigation into poison-laced letters sent to President Obama and others. The arrest of 41-year-old James Everett Dusky early Saturday ended a week in which investigators initially had zeroed in on a rival of Dusky's and then decided they had the wrong man. The hunt for a suspect revealed ties between the two men and an 80-year-old county judge who, along with Obama and U.S. Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, was among the targets of the letters. Dusky's house, business, and vehicles in Tupelo were searched earlier in the week, and he had been under surveillance. Dusky was charged with knowingly developing, producing, stockpiling, transferring, acquiring, retaining, and possessing a biological agent, toxin, and delivery system for use as a weapon, to wit, ricin, quotes the indictment against him filed by U.S. Attorney Felicia Adams and Daniel McMullen, the FBI agent in charge in Mississippi. Dusky's attorney, Lori Nail Basham, said she had no comment on the arrest at his Tupelo home, but earlier had said Dusky was cooperating fully with investigators. He faces up to life in prison if convicted. Dusky, by the way, has other legal problems. Earlier this month, he pleaded not guilty in state court to two child molestation charges involving three girls younger than 16. He also was appealing a conviction on a different charge of indecent exposure. Well, we'll be talking about exposure of a different type today, and I'm delighted to be joined by a fellow broadcaster right here at PRN.fm, and we'll be talking about the topic is the FBI and homegrown terrorism. In the aftermath of the April 15th Boston Marathon twin bombings, there are more questions than answers, not only about the shadowy figures said to be the terrorists, but also about the performance of governmental agencies and authorities charged with countering terrorism. Stephen Lendman, a renowned author and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization, puts the Federal Bureau of Investigation under the microscope today on Lead Stories. The agency, he says, has had and continues to have cozy relationships with terrorists and has been directly implicated in several terror plots. It is quite possible, he says, that alleged bombers Zokhar and Tamerlan Tsarnaev were set up to commit the bombings. He says the official story that we are getting is full of holes. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me. I should also mention that you are on that wonderful show. Please let us know what it is. Go ahead.
Utrice, thank you so much for inviting me on. My own program is the Progressive Radio News Hour on Fridays and on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays.
Right, on Fridays at 10 and on noon at noon Central Time also,
yes,
on Saturdays,
yes,
and Sundays. I'm so delighted that you can join me, and I know that you have been writing about this issue, not the specific issue, but the issue generally, the issue of the conduct of the feds and especially the FBI and its relationship to what is considered terrorism or what has been labeled terrorism. So let's start with your contention that the official story is full of holes. What kind of holes?
Well, I wrote an article. There's so much to discuss about this, Utrice.
Start where you wish.
I wrote an article just a few days ago that I titled FBI responsibility for U.S. terror plots. You could go back historically, especially post 9/11, and examine the various terror plots that made media headlines. It turned out that virtually always, I must add, that I've written about dozens, literally dozens, mostly Muslims, mostly men, bogusly charged with terror plots that the FBI was intricately involved in using entrapment. They call it a sting operation. There's nothing illegal about a sting operation, Utrice, but entrapment absolutely is illegal. Entrapment means getting somebody interested in or possibly to the point of involvement in something they never imagined, never dreamed of, never wanted to do, but for some reason, because of whatever beliefs they might have, the FBI informant or provocateur literally goaded them into getting involved in something and providing them maybe with fake weapons and bringing them up to the moment of truth and then pouncing on them and saying, aha, we foiled another terror plot. It looks like the Boston bombings followed that same scenario, except this time the bombings took place. And I think what's involved in that, Utrice, is that the administration and the FBI literally wanted a somewhat mass casualty event. I refer to it as a mini 9/11.
Wow. Could you expound on that a bit? Because it is so hard to wrap one's brain around the idea that a government will knowingly allow something this catastrophic to occur, knowing that they could head it off and prevent it, and all of the calamity, to think that that might have been something planned to cause this level of calamity and chaos and fear, to what end?
Well, I could go back to the late 1990s, Utrice, the Project for a New American Century, and they used in their own language the notion that for America to pursue its global dominance agenda, it needed an event on the order of a new Pearl Harbor. They used the term a new Pearl Harbor. Well, 9/11 was the new Pearl Harbor. The country, obviously, people in the country and around the world were very incensed about this. The first major attack on U.S. soil, dare I say, since the War of 1812, when the British burnt down the U.S. Capitol in Washington. But from then to 9/11, 2001, there never was such an event, never such a terrorist attack, you could call it that, on U.S. soil. Well, there's so much evidence, so much, and I've written so much about it and discussed it on my own program with marvelous guests who are really experts on this topic, that overwhelmingly points to what I would call the fact that this was a state-sponsored attack, that the so-called crazed Arabs who were blamed for it had absolutely nothing to do with it. I don't know who was on those planes. I don't know exactly what went on up in the air, but the story, so much about the official story, was absolutely false, and the experts just ripped it apart and presented best-case evidence. I've had a program on best-case evidence. I have another one coming up in a couple of weeks with a woman who was involved with others on an initiative called Consensus 9/11. It's got a panel of maybe up to 20 people, and they look for information that literally is verifiable, that discounts the official story and proves it as a bald-faced lie. They've assembled masses of good information. I think we may see something similar to the Boston attack, because it's being manipulated to say America is under attack, there are terrorists on our soil, Washington needs fear-mongering to get the public to go along with its war on terror, to go along with its imperial wars, and that's what's behind. That is what was behind 9/11, and I believe that was what's behind the Boston bombings.
All right, so let's take a definitive example. If you could walk us through, a specific example of which you were able to link the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other such counterterrorism agencies that set up individuals to commit these kinds of crimes.
I'll give you a wonderful one. There was an FBI operative by the name of Craig Montiel, Montiel, M-O-N-T-E-I-L-H. He was enlisted by the Southern California FBI to infiltrate Musk. He was a convicted felon. He cut a deal with the FBI. They gave him certain benefits in return. They paid him something like $130,000 over the number of months that he was performing FBI services. And he used a code name. He infiltrated the Musk. He tried to incite members of the mosque, Muslims, of course, all Muslims, to get involved in a terror attack. He tried to single out people who were very angry about America waging war on Islamic countries. And these people, the people he approached, were absolutely outraged by what he was doing. They literally filed a complaint at the same FBI office that enlisted him, if you can believe that. And push came to shove with this fellow Montiel, and he finally decided that he was being used. He didn't want anything more to do with this thing, and he went public. He went public and he told his story. He revealed FBI tactics. He said his handlers trained him to entrap Muslims in mosques, at home, and at work. And he said he was extremely well paid. It was more than $130,000. I think he got something like $170,000, and he worked for about 15 months. Not bad for a convicted felon. And again, he said, it just wasn't going the way he wanted it to go, and he went public and he explained all. I don't know if anybody else in his capacity ever did that, but he did, and because of what he told, it shows that this is the scheme the FBI does with other informants like him that will try to single out Muslims they think are vulnerable for this kind of influencing, getting them possibly to want to get involved in something that either is a terrorist attack or looks like one or could be one, so that the FBI can entrap them to say, look, we caught another terrorist, we're keeping America safe. Well, Montiel spelled it out, ABC. He did a marvelous job. This goes back a few years.
All right, let's get to this April 15th Boston Marathon bombing. When did you become suspicious of the official story?
The instant I heard about it, Utrice. Again, because I've written so much about this, just so much. All the people that I know were framed, and they're all innocent, extraordinary people. The five principles of the largest, most important Muslim charity in America, the Homeland Foundation, they were ruthlessly targeted, singled out. They did absolutely nothing. They committed no crime. But they were doing wonderful work, and the Bush administration wanted to stop them. They trumped up charges against them. They got them convicted. I think it took two trials, as I recall. I wrote several times about them, but this goes back a few years. I'd have to dig out my articles to check all of the facts. But I remember in their own words, they said things like, we gave toys, not tanks. We gave books, not bombs. And they went on and make more statements like that. That's exactly what they did. They gave charity to America. In America, they were based in Dallas, in the Dallas area. They gave American charity. They gave it in other countries, including in occupied Palestine. Before Hamas was declared a terrorist organization, which it is not, it's a legitimate government of Palestine. Apparently, Hamas got some of the aid that was given, but it was for the Palestinian people. The Bush administration did not want this kind of aid to go, so these people were singled out, wrongfully charged. The two main principals were sentenced to 65 years in prison. I remember that. The others got lesser sentences, 20 years, 15 years. And I think there were two more principals that, as of the latest article I wrote, they hadn't been caught. I think they left the country and they were lucky. But this is what America does to people like this. They put lawyers who defend these people in prison. Lynn Stewart, my friend, is in prison for a 10-year sentence that's a virtual death sentence. She did nothing. She defended Sheikh Rahman, the so-called blind sheikh. He was wrongfully charged with the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. They framed him. He was a former CIA asset. He came to America on a visa. given to him by FBI, CIA asset, given to him by the CIA when they didn't need him anymore. They framed him. They hung him out to dry. They got him convicted. And Lynn Stewart was part of Ramsey Clark's defense team. They both were doing the same thing. Ramsey Clark wasn't targeted, but Lynn was, not so much for this case, but for 30 years of defending people the government wanted to convict. And the message to lawyers was, if you dare defend somebody we want to put in prison, we'll go after you. That was the message.
Well, I did remark on this program that right after the suspects, one was killed, the older brother and the young one taken into custody, that it was unusual, and there was nothing really to boast about if two people who ostensibly were not pros at bombing things, so that this would have been their debut as bombers, put it that way. They were not seasoned bombers. Could hold an entire metropolitan area hostage for 5 days, including shutting down the city of Boston for one day completely. What does that say about the state of anti-terrorism tactics and training and all the money that had gone into anti-terrorism efforts? I questioned that to say that there is, of course, much more than meets the eye in any situation, but this struck me as odd, with the fact that the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the CIA allegedly knew of this. Is the, these are the official reports, of course. You know, I'm giving you the official reports that the older brother certainly was known. They've since put some elastic in that to include his mother, who supposedly is also a radical Islamist, and who, according to the last story I read, was discussing with the older son, Tamerlan, the phrase jihad showed up in the discussion. And, you know, I'm looking at it from a reporter's point of view, and something tells me that this is just not right. And then we had the immediate announcement afterwards by people like Police Commissioner Ray Kelly of the New York City Police Department and former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, actually saying, you know, they were on their way to blow up Times Square. And I said, well, you know, that's why it's called intelligence. If this were in fact intelligence, the last thing that they would want to do is to make this public. It would only further terrify the public. If in fact they were on their way to bomb Times Square, and for whatever reason they headed that off, wouldn't you just be, if you're in the intelligence business, wouldn't you just keep that quiet? Wouldn't that be something that you would want to keep quiet, especially because it did not happen? Why would you make a big deal about that publicly unless there is a particular reason for making these things known? So when you heard about the older brother who just had this 6 month leave of absence, he supposedly goes back home to Chechnya and becomes the new word is radicalized and comes back. And though he is supposedly known to the intelligence authorities, both in Russia and in the United States, and Russia has asked the United States to look into monitoring him and so forth, what is this supposed to be doing for the public? What are we supposed to be feeling about this knowledge, this information that we're getting?
I honestly believe that both brothers were set up, Patrice. There's so many strands that you mentioned, important issues to consider. On the one hand, I don't think either brother had any knowledge whatever about bomb making. That's pretty sophisticated stuff. It's not easy to make a bomb and have it to go off the way you want it to. You do need training. You need expertise. I would say this, clear evidence on the ground in Boston at the marathon finishing line were maybe up to 10 operatives from a Blackwater type organization called Clarity International. They were dressed in quasi-military outfits, not easily identifiable by people without any knowledge of these type people, but they had on combat boots. They had on the insignia, a skull of the Clarity International organization. They were right at the finish line. Apparently, they were on the side of the street where the bombs went off, but shortly before the explosions, they shifted to the other side of the street, obviously to get out of harm's way. Right after the bombings went off, an FBI truck was right there, Johnny, on the spot. People got out, the operatives got out with FBI caps on them. The older brother, Tamerlan, I saw a photo of him. Apparently, he was trying to surrender. He was stretched out prone on the ground. His arms were extended over his head. His fingers spread apart. There was no blood. There was no weapon near him. The FBI shot him, or Boston police, maybe both, shot him to death. And when his body showed up at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, the attending physician said his body was ridden with bullets from head to toe. They murdered him in cold blood. And again, I don't think he had anything to do with what went on. The younger brother was caught. I don't know how they found him. The stories were some woman spotted him under a tarpaulin at a boat, whatever that is. In any event, the Boston police or the SWAT teams or whatever, there were many thousands of them, literally locking down a 200 square mile of greater Boston. They found him, and I think they were trying to kill him, but they didn't. Why they didn't finish him off, I don't know, but he was wounded. He ended up in the hospital. That's, I guess, where he is now being treated. You have to ask an important question. Who benefits from an attack like this? Could these two young men have anything to gain whatsoever by blowing up bombs in a high-profile way at the finish line of the Boston Marathon? I just can't imagine what they would hope to gain by that. On the other hand, think of what the administration could get. 9/11 gave them a pretext for waging multiple imperial wars, for passing a range of police state laws at home. I wrote about them in detail in a number of articles, and Obama picked up where Bush left off. So the government at the federal, state, and local levels gained immensely from the 9/11 attack. Anybody involved, if they were people outside of the government, they certainly gained nothing whatsoever. These two young men couldn't possibly gain from this. If there isn't a reason to gain, why get involved in it in the first place? I don't think they did. Let me let you continue. I have other thoughts in my mind as well.
No, please continue your thoughts. I'm riveted. I'm listening.
Well, a very important issue is the fact that Boston was locked down, and I wrote about this in an article a couple of days ago. Think about this. Effectively, martial law was declared. The Constitution was suspended. People were rousted from their homes. Door-to-door searches. Police, FBI SWAT teams, National Guard, drug DEA agents, federal government, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents, many thousands, I saw the number 15,000, let's just say many thousands, combing these areas around Boston, knocking on doors, innocent people, early in the morning. They rousted families in their pajamas out on the streets. They strip searched some of them. They handcuffed some of them. They made them lie down face down on the ground. These people did nothing. Imagine this happening anywhere in America. And the issue I raised in my article was, literally, a state of siege, a police state was federally authorized, gone along with by local and state authorities. If it happened in Boston, it's going to happen in other cities. It could happen nationwide. It could be a permanent lockdown. It might not just be for so many hours. It could be a permanent constitutional suspension, martial law declaration on the pretext of terrorists infesting the country, which they are not doing, but people could be scared to believe they are. So in the interest of your security, in the interest of national security, we are taking away some of your liberties, and most people will go along with that. And Benjamin Franklin said it best, if you give up your freedom for security, you lose both.
Now, let me ask you the obvious question. Why couldn't it be true? Why couldn't it be just the way they said? These two young men had it in their minds to cause havoc. And the older son was the influencer of the younger son, the younger brother. And they decided, for whatever reasons, maybe just a personal mission to be martyrs for Islam because he was newly converted or newly invigorated in the religion and saw himself as a kind of misguided martyr and decided to do this act. Why couldn't that be feasible?
Oh, that's a very legitimate question, Eutrice. Absolutely legitimate. The answer I would give is, if it's true, show me the evidence. Show me credible evidence that absolutely shows that these two young men were involved in this attack. I've seen nothing. I've heard a lot of hearsay. I've heard a lot of accusations. I've seen no clear-cut evidence. What you get in the media, as you know well, Gary Null was discussing it before this program came on, and I've certainly discussed it many times in my program. You can believe nothing coming out of official statements from government. You can believe nothing the major media report. I call them the scoundrel media for good reason. You simply can't believe what they report. They basically repeat the official line. Well, where is the evidence? If it's there, then show it, prove it, show it in black and white, and if it's there, I'll believe it, and I'll write a new article, and I'll apologize for everything I said.
So the photographs and the bits of tape showing them being present with their knapsacks and their backpacks, ostensibly containing the bombs, these things are not evidence to you.
Well, they had knapsacks on, but one brother had a black whip knapsack on. The other brother had a white knapsack on. They accused Adoka, if I'm pronouncing his name right, the younger brother, now hospitalized, of having a pressure cooker in his black knapsack. Well, he had a white knapsack on. It wasn't black. So who were they talking about, number one? I remember my mother used a pressure cooker at home. It's pretty big. The knapsacks that were shown on the backs of these two young men weren't big enough to hold the kind of pressure cooker my mother used, and I assume they're about the same size today, because if you want to cook enough food in the pressure cooker, it needs to be so big. If it's too small, you can't cook enough food in it. So I don't know how a pressure cooker could fit in a knapsack that size. I think that discounts the official story.
And what about the showdown, the shootout in Watertown, where apart from allegedly trading bullets with the police and other agents assembled in Watertown when they were cornered in Watertown, supposedly they also lobbed explosives and some kind of a homemade type of grenade at the shooters. So that's not convincing to you.
Well, it's not convincing to me for a number of reasons. I don't think there was any shootout. I think all the shooting was one way. But the official story was that I think both brothers wore explosive vests strapped to their bodies. Well, that was impossible because Tamerlan had his body riddled with bullets from head to toe. But he arrived in one piece at the hospital. If he had an explosive vest on, he would have arrived in pieces at the hospital, Eutrice.
I saw a picture of his body laid out, and it was gruesome, but there were many bullet holes, you're correct about that, and there was a very large gash on the left side of his chest going toward his abdomen, from the top of the chest going toward the abdomen on the left-hand side of his body. But there was no, if he were wearing an explosive device, you would expect that his entire torso would have been eviscerated with the impact of that kind of explosives.
Oh, absolutely. And if it didn't blow both legs and both arms off, it certainly would have inflicted wounds on a large area of his body, and that simply was not the case except for the bullet wounds. So there's another official story that you can completely discount. And again, with Zoka, if he had an explosive vest on and the FBI or Boston police shot at him, I can't imagine that one bullet would not have struck that vest, and he would have gone up in pieces. It didn't happen. But again, we've only got one side of the story, only the official story from the police and the FBI and so on. We haven't heard the other side of the story. The media reports claim that Dzhokhar confessed. Well, I don't believe he confessed, because I saw an image of his last Facebook comment before he was arrested. It was to his father, I believe, and it said, I had nothing to do with this. I'm using my words now. I had nothing to do with this. They set me up. That was his Facebook message.
We're talking with Stephen Lenman, who hosts right here on PRN.FM, the PRN NewsHour, and we're talking about the FBI and homegrown terrorism. So, what should happen now? Should the FBI, should there be a major inquiry? I mean, we saw how the inquiry into 9/11 went, even though the commission did say there were huge questions and huge gaps in the credibility of the FBI and the CIA and other investigating authorities with respect to the attack. Even the governor who held headed the commission, Governor Kaine, was particularly vocal about being lied to. Do you think that a similar commission should be put together right away, and that it might yield some answers that should be forthcoming?
Well, whether they will or they won't be, Utrice, I don't think it matters at all. The 9/11 Commission was a setup. It was a setup to cover up, to whitewash what happened. And it's true. And David Ray Griffin, who's written 10 books on the 9/11 event, and one of his books was on the 9/11 Commission, he just ripped the commission to pieces. David has gone through some health issues, but prior to that, he was on my program a couple of times. I would love to get him back. I have other people come on in his place who know David and work with him, have worked with him very closely, and these are the people involved in what's called Consensus 9/11. But maybe when David is up to it again, I'll get him back on my program to discuss the latest that he's aware of on 9/11. But he's really the expert on the topic, to have written 10 books on it, and again, one on the 9/11 Commission. There was simply a whitewash commission. So if there's a similar commission for these Boston bombings, it'll be a complete whitewash. We'll get the official story. We won't get the truth.
So the two young men, Tamerlan and his younger brother, deny any involvement, and they use the word that technically, I mean, we're paraphrasing, they use the word that they were set up. In fact, the mother actually said the words set up. The mother is now implicated as perhaps being an influencing force for when Tamerlan actually returned home to his home in Chechnya and was under her influence, supposedly, and it also invigorated his belief in Islam, his radical belief in Islam, and he returns. Where do you think this whole thing, do you believe that at some point Tamerlan did have direct contact with FBI operatives in the United States? Was it in the United States that he was cultivated, or was he cultivated outside, or both? Or how do you think this arrangement is working, or has been working?
His mother said that the FBI hounded him for years. They were monitoring him. They were following the websites that he visited online. Lots of people visit all kinds of websites. As a writer, I go to websites, any kind of website I can access that might give me information that I can use for articles that I write. So if I went to a website that the FBI would call a radical site or a jihadist site or whatever language they want to use, would that make me a terrorist? I'm just researching to get information for what I want to include in out of it. I'm looking for real information, truthful information. So I'll go to any website that might be able to give it to me, and I'll take the information I get. If I think it's credible, I would use it. But I probably, if I do go to a site, I would indicate that I got the information from this source or from that source. So I won't say I'm not saying this. This is what the source says. and I'll give attribution that way. But my going to these websites doesn't mean that I'm planning to be a bomb-throwing terrorist. So I don't know what Tamerlan did or Zoka did in terms of what they accessed online. But whatever they did certainly in no way suggests that they were planning to be bomb-throwers. You need credible evidence to prove this, and I haven't seen it. My understanding, by the way, is that they were born... I may be wrong on this, but I believe they were born in Kyrgyzstan, and they later moved to Dagestan. They may have relatives in Chechnya. I guess I'm not certain how close where they lived at different points, and in Chechnya, what the distance is from those points to Chechnya. But the so-called militant organization, or at least one of them in Chechnya, I'm not familiar with Chechen militant organizations. They said their only beef is with Russia. They have no beef with America. They had no link with Tamerlan. They gave him no instruction in bomb making, and they simply wanted to make it very clear that they had nothing to do with what goes on, what went on in Boston, or whatever might go on in America. Again, they repeated it, they have no beef with America.
The FBI, you claimed in your article, has this population of a nation, a small nation of undercover agents, numbering some 15,000 who, you say in your article, earn more or around $100,000 per assignment. Has anybody looked into what percentage of the budget the FBI allocates toward undercover operations?
Oh, that's a marvelous point. I wish I could find that out. I think it's probably a black budget. I know the CIA has a black budget, and the other U.S. intelligence agencies, NSA, and every branch of the military has their own intelligence operation, and I guess the Pentagon has a separate one, an all-embracing one. But there are 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. The FBI would be aside from that. But their budgets, I don't believe, are published. It's all black information. But I remember some years ago, there was a former CIA employee who was in charge of budgets, and she went public at the time. This might have been 5 or 6 years ago, and she talked about a CIA budget of something on the order of $50 billion. This was before Bush ramped it up considerably. I would imagine whatever it was 5 or 6 years ago is probably double that now, but they're black budgets, and I don't think there's any way for mere mortals like you or me, Utrecht, to get our hands on that information.
And mere mortals. All right, so here's another corroborative piece that we got. We got the testimony. We haven't gotten it directly, but the Boston Globe reporter who wrote the story talked about the person hijacked, whose car was carjacked, I should say, who went by the name of Danny. And Danny talked about these two young men who took his car, threatened to kill him, basically used his card and withdrew $800 from the ATM. And although they spoke to each other in a language that he didn't understand, the word Manhattan came up several times. And essentially the question was, could the car take them safely to Manhattan? Was it in a position to go directly there? That piece of information doesn't corroborate the official account to you?
I didn't look into it. I heard about that, but I honestly didn't look into it, Utrecht. There was another accusation that one of the brothers held up a 7-Eleven store, and I believe the brother absolutely denied any involvement in it. So whether they held up a person driving in a car, I honestly don't know. If they knew they were being hunted and they were going underground, they were absolutely terrified. Imagine how you or I would feel if the FBI said, we are the criminal that committed this heinous act, whatever it might be, something where you are in New York or where I am in Chicago, and we knew the FBI was hunting us down, and I mean, they were out for blood. I mean, I would do anything to go undercover and hide to get away from them. I don't think I would hold up a car, and I don't have a gun. I've never held a gun in my hand since I got out of the Army.
But you know, at first they did report that the two were involved in the holdup at the 7-Eleven, and then later recanted and said no, that was not correct.
Oh, I didn't notice that. But whether they held up a car or not, I honestly don't know. But what we both know is they both were terrified. I would be terrified. You would be terrified.
Who killed the MIT police officer?
I honestly don't know. Again, that was a story that we only have one version of it. What actually happened at MIT? There's a lot of violence in cities like Boston. In my own city of Chicago, there is more than one gun-related killing per day in Chicago. I'm certain Boston has a cheer of gun killings. Was one of the brothers or both of them involved in that MIT incident, or was it somebody else? We don't know.
We don't know. We'll take your calls and questions right after this break at 888-874-4888. Stephen gives you 2 seconds to clear, to get some water, get a sip of water, whatever. And we'll come back and take some questions and comments at 888-874-4888 right after this. Listening to PRN.FM. This is Eutrice Lead. The program is Lead Stories, and I have the great privilege and honor of sharing this time with Stephen Landman, who hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour right here on PRN, airing at 11 o'clock Eastern Time on Thursdays, and at 1 o'clock on Saturdays and Sundays, rediscussing the FBI and homegrown terrorism. Your calls and questions at 888-874-4888. Chris from Queens, thank you for calling.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, Chris?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, hi. I had to throw in my 2 cents here because, first of all, I'd like to corroborate. I have a couple of quick points I'd like to make. I'd like to totally corroborate what Mr. Ledman said regarding Tamerlan. I was watching a movie at that about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was kind of, you know, shifting around. And I came across this scene that was taking place. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe 2:30 around there, all right? And then I came across this scene that was taking place in Massachusetts. And I saw exactly what he described earlier. Tamerlan, it was his body on the ground.
Are you there? Did we lose her? Oh, Chris, I'm so sorry about that. Well, hopefully she can call back. Bill from Atlanta, you're on the air with Stephen Landman. Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Is this Chris or Bill?
This is Bill. Can you hear me? This is Bill?
Yes, Bill.
Okay.
Sorry.
I was just going to comment first, Steve. There's like so much orchestrated events that are going on, and I always kind of wonder, you know, what's really going on? What's the underlying reason for all of it? There's the obvious reasons, you know, the energy, the justifying invasions, all that. But maybe there's something moving under the carpet that, you know, really hasn't even been talked about of why people's attention is needed to be diverted. And also, just specifically to the Boston situation, there was the pictures that everyone's familiar with. You can Google and if you look hard, you can see that the pictures were actually posted in several different places days before the event actually took place, which means the pictures themselves have been staged, which to me, you know, you can't fake that. And that's all you need to absolutely unequivocally prove that you know, the whole thing is faked. Anyway, that's about all.
Thank you, Bill. Any reaction, Stephen?
Oh, indeed. It's so easy to fake things. You can have fake pictures, fake videos. The entire thing can be contrived. Eutrice, there's a wonderful line that I've used a couple of times, quoted a couple of times in articles I've written from Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore. Simple line it goes, things aren't always as they seem. Skim milk masquerades masquerades as cream. Well, that's exactly what goes on. The official story says one thing. The truth, when it comes out too late to matter, as I like to say, proves something entirely different. But it's so easy. The people who do this are experts. They could fool anybody. They could fool their family members, their children, their spouses, their parents. They're geniuses at fakery. This is their business. This is what they do. So again, never take official stories on face value. Look for best evidence possible that anybody can find and make your judgments based on those. But the official stories usually turn out to be very, very false.
Well, we have Chris back again. Chris, quickly, could you ask your question or your comment, make your comment?
Hi. I was just, I don't know at what point I got off. I just wanted to say that the body that I was watching at 2 o'clock in the morning on the television set that they were showing, the cops were squatting, their guns were drawn, and this was a body on the ground, and it was exactly, it was not being reported as a dead body. The parroting media were saying he appears to be shot, but it looked to me, and the way it was reported, I cannot remember every specific word, but they were saying you could see his face, his eyes were closed, but his fingers were spread apart, and it seemed to me as if he was gripping the sidewalk somehow. So I wanted to say that because when Stephen Ledman just said earlier about the fact that it was a dead body, I am assuming he's referring to that image because it struck me as very odd. I have relatives living right in Watertown, and I spoke to one of them yesterday, and I just wanted to say that I recognized the area, and it was a side street. It was because it's a very residential area. One other point I'd like to make, and by the way, at that point, he had not died yet, according to the reports. They didn't know, supposedly, but I was wondering to myself, if this person is down on the ground, face down, his eyes closed, even if he had been shot, I couldn't understand why the police officers were squatting with their guns drawn, you know. And by the way, this video that they keep on reeling over and over that they show with the backpacks, and then they show them walking down Boylston Street without the backpacks, why are they not showing? Now, we know that there were cameras everywhere, okay? Why are they not showing the specific point which they claim that Zakhar put down his knapsack? They're not showing that. And all of the witnesses, the testimony that's coming through is coming through a second person. Okay, I just wanted to make that point. I want to know why they're not showing the point where he put down his, why we're not privileged to see that video and we see the other one, which they want
all
to
right.
print. Okay,
thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for calling back, too. Thank you. Any reaction, Stephen?
Well, again, I absolutely believe that this was Tamerlan, the older brother, that he was surrounded, I guess, or cornered by police or FBI operatives, whatever, with guns drawn. I mean, what would anybody do if they faced a situation like that? Probably when he was on his feet, he put his hands in the air. The reason he was on the ground was no doubt he was ordered to go down on the ground in a prone position, face down, and he had his hands extended over his head, fingers spread apart. Again, no blood. If he'd been shot, you would have seen some evidence, maybe a stained shirt or whatever. You might have seen blood on the ground. I don't think he was shot at all when that photo was taken. But again, you don't hear anything reported about this in the major media.
Sarah, you're next, and if you can do it quickly as we're running out of time. I'm sorry.
Greetings to you, Teresa, Mr.
Thank
Ledman.
You.
I'll be very brief. Thanks, Mr. Ledman, for being so descriptive in what you are saying, because I firmly believe that these boys were set up. They were patsies, as I told you, Teresa, in a couple shows. And those, the officer that you mentioned, the MIT officer who was killed, I do believe he could have been killed in a crossfire, because remember, they were very zealous at what happened in Dorner's situation in California, where they shot this woman, mistaking her for Dorner, for Dorner's vehicle. So they do those things, but since these boys are being, men are being blamed, they're going to put the blame on them to say that they were the ones who did it. But 7-Eleven did come out and say that their robbery had nothing to do with these young men. They were not the ones who committed the robbery at their store.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, Sarah, for your input. Well, Stephen, it looks like we are getting close to the end of our program today, and it also looks like we will have to have another date.
Oh, I would love to come back. I would add one thing, you, Teresa. I grew up in Boston. I know exactly where this incident took place, in Copley Square in Boston, a very, very prominent place. I spent a lot of time in Copley Square, so it was very shocking to me when I heard that this happened. Not just that it happened, but it happened in the town I grew up in, and the spot was a place that I know so well.
I want to thank you so much for being with me today. Of course, we'll be figuring out when next we could arrange for you to come back, because I still think we need to follow through. We've been deconstructing the media, and basically we've been talking prior to this effort, to this event, I should say, how the media behave, especially in a time of crisis, that we are told one story and there's only one story. And then it goes through its permutations, and then you see evidence that they're not quite satisfied with the explanations they're getting, and they begin to ask questions. So hopefully they'll be asking the right questions soon, but I'm glad that you started off asking the right questions from the word go. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Dutree. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Same here. Thank you so much for listening and tuning in. You want to spread the word, of course, and let people know that this is the station, PRN.FM. And, of course, you would want to check out Steve Ledman's Progressive Radio News Hour on Thursdays at 11 Eastern Time, and Saturdays and Sundays at 1 Eastern Time. And you'll be back tomorrow, and we'll continue the conversation. Take care.